Kabbalistic Teaching of the Female Prophets, the Seven Holy Women of Ancient Israel, is the new book from local author and broadcaster Zohara Meyerhoff Hieronymus. Zoe's new book draws the connections between the seven female prophets, who are Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Chana, Avogil, Hilda, and Esther, and the seven lower Sefirot on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, the days of the week, the human body, Jewish rituals and holidays, and the seven Israeli species, olives, grapes, wheat, barley, figs, dates or date honey, and pomegranates. In her book, she argues that an integration of all these elements shows us a way of living and acting in the world in any given situation in a way that's most harmonious to the roots nature of the Creator in whose image we are made, she writes. I sat down with Zoe to discuss these ideas. We began with a sojourn of spiritual searching she began many years ago.
Like many Jewish people, even at 16, I wouldn't be confirmed. I had to send back all my gifts, say I couldn't make that kind of commitment, though I had this love and intimate relationship with the Creator through nature. I found that I couldn't say, oh yes, I'm going to observe Sabbath and all the holidays, and I proclaim myself to be a Jewish woman. And at 16, I said, I can't do that. And I went and did the 10,000 things, and like many people, studied Buddhism and Amerindianism and Hinduism and Shintoism, and all of them share a lot in common, which is that we are being told that we are spiritual beings in a mortal body, and that it's a very short experience, but that there's a purpose for it, and that's for our own development and refinement. Kabbalah had always interested me.
And Kabbalah is?
Kabbalah means received tradition, and so it was an oral tradition for many, many generations. It's said that Adam was actually the first Kabbalist, and why do they say that? Because Adam was able to name every living thing, and he didn't just give it a name like a title. Names in Hebrew are vessels of particular energy, so when he called a dog, a chien, well, that's French. Kelev, I think. Kelev is dog. It was because that was its actual energy state. So when he gave names to things, he could identify their purpose and essence. So Kabbalah, and going back to its traditional root being thought to be in Adam, says that all of us then are capable of receiving this tradition. And what I discovered after really beginning a very serious examination of it back in 2002 until this date was that so many of the traditions I had studied found their roots in Kabbalah. In 2002, it was during the Sukkot holiday. It's a seven-night ritual, an eight-day ritual. I went in on my first night, and all of a sudden, I had this incredible, I guess what some would call peak experience or a revelation. I was surrounded in the most incredible love, like sweet honey. I can't really describe it. It was just overwhelming. It brought me to tears, but then, boof, right in front of my mind, in my mind's eye, I saw this whole thing, that the Tree of Life is composed of 10 spheres, which they call sephirot, that you mentioned. And when you actually look at this map, it's actually designed like the human body. At the top of the tree are three spheres. There's three pillars. They're parallel. There's a right, a middle, and a left. And then at the top of the Tree of Life is our head. And then there's a ball to the right and a ball to the left that are equidistant. And that represents the father and the mother, or wisdom and understanding. Then there's another below it, like at our neck level. And that stands for understanding and knowledge. Then we move down the body. There's a right arm, which is called loving kindness or chesed. The left arm, which is considered gevura or strength and discrimination. We move down the body further. We come to the torso, and the center of the Tree of Life is called Teferet, which means splendor, beauty, truth. We come down the tree even further. The right leg is strength and attachment and endurance. It's called Netzach. The left leg is called Hod, which is humility, surrender, royalty. Then you come down the body further. There's another sephirot at the generative organs. It's called Yesod. It means covenant. It's the kingdom. It's our attachment. And then finally, we come down to our feet, which is the bottom of the Tree of Life called Malchut, which means sovereignty, the individual sovereign human who carries out the will of their head. So in short, this description I've just made of these 10 balls on a structure of three parallel lines basically says that we as a human each have mastery opportunities over our own kingdom. So that when you hear these amazing sayings in every tradition, you know, you are the king of your kingdom, you are the queen of your empire, teach your children to do good. It's not just just your own biological children. Children are your words, your thoughts, your deeds. The description I gave you of the tree of life in the human body, these seven prophetesses fit into it. And you had mentioned the Arizal. Isaac Luria, the great Kabbalist, was one of the first to say that each of these seven lower sephirot of the tree of life represent the seven species of Israel: wheat, barley, grapes, figs, pomegranate, olive oil, and date honey. And then there was another great Kabbalist named Moshe Cordovero, the Ramach. He said, no, you know, the seven sephirot, those lower ones of chesed and gevurah, love and judgment and beauty, those seven that I described, are related to the seven prophetesses. And that's what I saw in my revelation in the sukkah. Without knowing any of these historic correspondences, I guess they were allowing me to make the discovery. And so what I found was, the seven prophetesses' lifespans were about every 100, 150 years or so, one of them shows up on the world stage. And what I was shown in that revelation, which is really what's new, I mean, if I could say I've made a new contribution to Judaism, which I believe and all the critics say it is that these seven women, I asked myself, well, if there were 48 prophets plus Moses, that's 49, and only seven women? That's a ratio of 1 to 7. So, of course, that intrigued me. You know, the joke, how many men does it take to put in a light bulb? That came to mind afterwards, of course. So what I discovered was these seven women each fall into the tree of life in a sequence, in the exact sequence in which we're told the light descends. So Sarah, the first prophetess, is the seed of life. She was the matriarch of the Jewish people. She taught us loving kindness. She taught us about Sabbath, the mitzvah of baking bread, of the mikvah, which is the ritual immersion bath for purification. Well, what do you do after something is created or it's conceived, it's born? So Sarah's the seed. And then Miriam came and she was the deliverance. Not only was she a midwife, but she took the Jewish people to a new state of consciousness. She's the one that walked across when they were going across the Red Sea. It was the women who went first and the women who celebrated the crossing. And she, when she was little, man, she was tough. She started prophesying at the age of 5.
Now, let me just interrupt you there because I'm going to pick up with the next prophetess.
Sure.
But two things. I mean, A, with Miriam, I mean, you heard that about women going first, but it was never given any significance.
There was isn't it interesting? And it's also said that the women were given the holiday of Rosh Chodesh, the new moon, for not participating in the building of the golden calf. You know, a lot of these teachings are classical Judaic teachings, but if you're not an Orthodox person or you don't study in the yeshivas, you don't even hear sometimes the basic literal Torah story, or you don't pay attention. It's not that it's not there. All of my work is done straight out of the Torah with another collection of the oral teachings primarily. And then it gets more sophisticated with gematria, turning letters into numbers, which is also a way you devise meanings in things. So anyway, so back to Miriam,
to
your question. Well, and to the question about Miriam, because we remember Miriam every day in our prayers, but we remember her for her moment of what one would say was arrogance when she said to God, why can't I prophesy? Moses is my little brother. I'm the one that predicted he would be born. I'm the one that brought my parents back together so they could give birth to the Redeemer. Why can't I be the one to speak to the people? So for that, and challenging Moses for marrying a Cushite woman, it said that she was given leprosy. And she's already now a very old woman. You know, she lived to 126. She started the Exodus at 86. So in any event, we're talking about a matriarch of the Jewish people. But she brought the Jewish people to a new awareness of what it takes to deliver something. There's boundaries. You know, it's one thing to be loving. It's another thing to know how to love, when to love, how much to love. And so she taught us boundaries, like Sarah's the river, Miriam's the boundaries of the river. Sarah's the seed, Miriam teaches us about deliverance. And all this applies to our lives. You know, the whole purpose of Kabbalah is self-management and self-refinement, because the outer world reflects our inner states. You know, terrorism around the world is not just, oh, them out there. And as you know from covering current events, which I did for 10 years every day of the year, mm-hmm. It broke my heart to see what darkness we were capable of as a humanity. And I started understanding that it wasn't just out there, and it wasn't them, and it wasn't the other. I had to examine where in myself was I like Saddam Hussein. Had I ever behaved in a way that was tyrannical? I had to say yes, of course. So how easy it would be for a human to be born who characterizes that quality to an extreme. In the same way we've met people like the Dalai Lama, who we experience his love being. So he'd be a representation of chesed, or of loving kindness. All right, so Miriam took us to deliverance. Then Devorah, what happened to the people of Israel? They were wanderers, then they were delivered from Egypt, and then they came together and they created moral order. So Devorah was a judge. She was also a general. But it teaches us that these are sequences we go through in our own lives, whether it's about changing a relationship or a place we work or in our own family or within our own person. So when we create something, then we have to decide, what do we keep, what do we not keep? Mm-hmm. What's good, what's not good? That's the left hand. Then we go to the middle. We make it beautiful. We try to harmonize. We try to elevate everything to its highest place. And when we do that in relationships or in the world, it means whoever we work with, we try to find a way to elevate them, not put them down, not criticize them. So Devorah taught the people that there is a moral order, that there is beauty and truth. And it comes from knowing that there's right and wrong and the repercussions for that right and wrong. You know, sentencing somebody isn't just to say, well, there you go. It's actually to help them restore their own spiritual foundation to a balance. So it's actually a blessing for somebody to be judged in this life rather than when they cross over.
Of course, we don't function in
no,
that way.
No, at that level.
We don't function at that level at all.
We don't.
Sentencing is revenge.
Yes,
there's nothing
exactly
wrong. We're going to put you away and lock you up and never let you out again.
Exactly.
We'll make it as miserable as we can. So you.
Yeah, and particularly for nonviolent crimes like the use of drugs. I mean, how insane is our culture?
You know, the Christian sense, I mean, penitentiary was penitence.
Yes.
You were there to
And that's actually the whole purpose of teshuva, of returning to God, is to refine, is to give up your old ways, is to really see that every day is an opportunity to be a new person, to change yourself in some way, to add something new to your life every day. So after Devorah taught us moral order, we see the Jewish people coming into institutionalized ritual. So they've gone from way out there in the desert in the tent, which was the first holy sanctuary of Sarah's, and then we had Miriam bringing us through the desert, and then we had Devorah creating moral order. The next is the Temple of Shiloh, which was Chana or Netzach. So it tells us after we've given birth to something, after we've decided what to keep, what not to keep, how to make it beautiful, then we decide in what way does it value our spiritual heritage. Meaning, how is your radio program or is somebody's job at the grocery store a service to the Creator? In what way does it attach them to their soul, to their own soul? And that's what Chana taught us, was this spiritual endurance, that she wanted a child and she prayed and prayed, and 18, 19 years taunted by her other co-wife. And finally she conceived and eventually gave birth to 5 children. Her son Samuel was a great prophet and a ruler over Israel. But she taught us that you have to take everything you do and attach it somehow within your heart and soul to the Creator. And then Avigail brought us to the next level of our relationship to the Creator and each other, and she moved us to Hebron, married King David after keeping him from killing her husband and whole household, and she taught us humility because she went out, risked her own life to make peace. So it teaches us that when we surrender our ego, we're capable of making peace in any situation. Doesn't always mean people listen to us, but we can come to peace within. And then finally, the last two prophetesses, Huldah helped the king return to Judaism. This is before the destruction of the first temple. And what she brought the people was an understanding that there is a world to come, that the physical world is preparation for the spiritual world, and that our words, thought, and action are the garments of the soul in the afterlife. So she brought the king back to Judaism and all the people back to Judaism. They were now in Jerusalem. So you see, we've come from the tent in the wilderness. We're coming all the way down the Tree of Life till finally we have Queen Esther in Persia, and she was a ruler over 127 nations. And she taught everybody that when we commit everything we have, our intelligence, our gifts, our money, our bodies, our clothing, our words, to the Creator and to refining the physical world and to taking care of each other and being good stewards, that we actually are worthy of redemption. And redemption means no longer identifying ourselves as an ego in the body, but as a soul that's using a body to do spiritual work.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the very long story that 400 some pages share, but that's the basis of what these 7 women showed us.
But some of the things you also point out in this book that I think that are just fascinating and for people who take time with this is that, because there's so much in this book.
It's a study book, for sure.
It's a study book.
I'd say the first chapter on prophecy, which explains prophecy is for the community to come back to God, and that all of us are designed to be prophets. the beginning of Torah's creation and the end is prophecy. And that's what spurned my thinking, wow, prophecy is for all humans and that we're meant to be prophets, all of us.
As always, my rabbi told me when I was very young that that doesn't happen anymore.
But it does.
But that's
yes, I know.
The common logic.
Exactly. Right. And when I asked my rabbi about reincarnation and angels, they said, what was I dreaming about? You know, so there you go. Their training isn't always so up to snuff either.
And other thing that the complexity of language is in this book too. And I just take a couple of minutes, not real long, just kind of explain it as we give people an overview of what you've written. That the Hebrew alphabet, as you describe it, and you described it as simply and as well as anybody I've ever seen describe it.
Thank you. What did I say?
Talking about the levels of definition of the letters in the Hebrew alphabet, that they have literal meanings, numerical meanings, spiritual meaning, that all these the letters have many meanings. So that's it's even though it's a small language, not a lot of letters, not a lot of words. 22 letters, not a lot of words, but it's the depth behind the words and the layers of meaning behind each letter, therefore each word.
Well, let's take your name as an example. Well, I don't know. Do you have a Hebrew name?
Meir.
Meir. Oh, that means light. So I guess it would be a mem, maybe a vav, and a resh. So mem, because Mark is also the beginning of your English name, a mem is a container. It's a mother letter. It's somebody capable of holding and giving birth and incubating many things. So it's really, it's a great letter for a name to begin with. You know, in the same way, any word, and English you can do to some degree, but we'll finish your name.
Okay.
So mem is this incubator. It's a mother letter. It also represents the womb. It also represents water. So it means that you have a very soft nature, meaning essentially a being that's intuitive and can hold many things at once and keep them until it's time to give birth to them. Like conversation is really that. You have to hold thoughts in your mind and then you speak the thought after you've thought about it for a while. That's a mem. If you have a yud, let's say it's, I don't know if it would be a mere, let's say yud because it's such a great letter. Yud is the number 10. Mem, by the way, is 40. So the yud is 10, and it signifies the inseminating seed of life. Like God's seed of life is the yud. It's in the Creator's name. And so a mem and then a yud is real fertile. I mean, this would be a mother and a father coming together, or your male and female nature coming together within your person. So the mem then holds all these things. The yud is this static kind of insemination from the Creator, and then a resh, which is 200, is the end of your name, and that's really the head. It's also a leader. It's a teacher. It's somebody bringing down these holy teachings of the Creator and being able to give them over. If you think of a resh, it looks like a water spigot.
Right.
So in Kabbalah, that's what you do. You take any word of anything in Hebrew, and I didn't add that up. So let's say it's a mem, which is 40, a yud, which is 10, and a resh, which is 200, so that's 250. So then you would look for other words that are equal to that same numerical value of 250, and you would get the story of your name out of Torah. And it teaches you then qualities about your own destiny.
You know, it's really interesting. It's a total aside, which we cannot get into today, but it'd be interesting to have a group talk about this. What flashed in my head as soon as you said that was that in the African-American world, numerology is a huge thing.
Oh, good.
And has been since the time of slavery.
Right.
So there's no mistaking, there's a real relationship thing between the fact that the African-American spirituality is based in the Old Testament because of slavery and the relationship to that and numerology and language. There's all these things that people never put together about.
Don't know their root.
What the root of all that is.
Well, you know, it's said that Kabbalah is meant to be given over to the world and that this is the generation for it. And what they mean by that is the teachings for self-management are meant to be given over, whether it's managing the economy or managing issues of housing and health, that all of these issues can be addressed when we look at the structure of the Kabbalistic tree of life, because everything is modeled from it.
So talk about I'd like to kind of bring us around to the 21st century here.
Sure.
And this book and kind of wrap it up with what this book says to you and what you think it says to the world at the moment and what we're living now and through the eyes of these prophetesses and the work you've done with them.
Firstly, I find them very close and personal. When people say, who are your friends? I go, well, I've got these great seven women who are my friends, Sarah, Miriam, Devorah. And it's really true. I now feel like I'm in their company all the time. Uh-huh. And when I don't know what to do, I think, now, what would Miriam do? Or what would Devorah do? And by that, I'm saying to myself, how should I respond to this situation? Should I respond with a limitation? Should I be open and giving? Should... What I discovered in Sarah's story in particular, which is the very first story of the first prophetess in the beginning of the Jewish people, was the story of Ishmael and Hagar, and why and what does it mean for today? And I might, as I mentioned to you before we started, be the only person on earth who believes this, but I think that world terrorism is actually an expression of our arrogance. And certainly we see it in a person who's willing to take out so many lives and blow themselves up and think that that's going to get them to heaven somehow. That within their story is the root of terrorism, and it says it right in the Torah. You know, Ishmael's a wild ass of a man, his hand against all his brothers and his brother's hand against him. If that doesn't describe Islamic terrorism, I don't know what does. So to me, it says that the root of terrorism was this initial separation, which God told Abraham to go ahead and listen to Sarah, that she knew what she was doing, and that terrorism is actually going to bring the world together. In the same way global warming will bring the world together, they're both expressions of hotness, of heatedness. And I think if you look at global warming, that came out of our greedy selfishness. We've known for decades about global warming. We've known all kinds of energy systems that have been buried alive, whether it was the electric car or solar energy or geothermal or whatever. But no, you know, the greed of the industry and the greed of the stock market wanted us to keep doing these things that has heated up the planet. So that's just pure selfishness. And that's in Kabbalah, that's all we really talk about, is distinguishing in any moment of your life, are you being selfless or are you being selfish? Are you doing something for somebody because it rewards you, or is it really selfless? And there's always degrees. So I think that terrorism is actually an expression of a spiritual deficit of loving kindness in all of us. It's not just those people. It's not just the Middle East. Terrorism is worldwide now. It's just our press only focuses on the Middle East, but it's happening everywhere. And everywhere, people are going to have to come together and work together towards a greater spiritual education of what is the purpose of being born. And the purpose is to elevate all life and to refine life and to refine ourselves until we really do act and behave like a creator who takes care of what they create. And so that's one thing, is that global warming and terrorism, I believe, are expressions of we're too hot. We don't listen enough to the holy word. And water, on the other hand, which Miriam's life showed us, if we're following Sarah and then Miriam, that's our challenge in this century as well. Will we have water? Will we have enough water? Will there be too much water? Will it be polluted? So that when you start to look at their lives, you actually see that what they taught then is as applicable today as it was in the biblical communities. And maybe that's why it's being revealed now. I mean, I can't explain why, of all the great scholars who have lived in the Jewish people's history, who have written incredible books, that this work should have come through me. It made no sense, really. So I just sort of felt like it was a blessing, and I had to go forward and present what I was shown, because it's for now.
This has been wonderful. It's always good to see you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for sharing this in the book, Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets, with Zohara Meyerhoff Hieronymus. And thank you very much.
Thank you.